The Harvey Effect, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Harvey Weinstein's gone from Hollywood legend to social pariah over allegations of sexual harassment, even though he denies that he assaulted women.
He keeps insisting through a spokesperson that anything he did was consensual.
But it's not just Harvey Weinstein, and it's not just the U.S. Today on a special edition of The World, we join the global conversation sparked by the Weinstein case. We'll hear from this Canadian.
I was the lucky one, you know, who got all the stuff where he touched my body, or he would bring me into the soundproof studio and grab my ass and say that he couldn't control himself because of my skirt.
And we'll hear from women in Nigeria, China, Italy, and Britain who are also speaking out. It's a global take on a social problem on a special edition of The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Jasmine Garst, and this is The World.
It's a Friday on The World, and today we're doing something different on the show.
Yeah, we're going to talk about this.
The Motion Picture Academy expels mega producer Harvey Weinstein. Multiple women have accused him of sexual harassment and assault.
Actress Catherine Kendall says she was just 23 when a naked Weinstein chased her around his Manhattan apartment.
Hollywood has been rocked by the Harvey Weinstein scandal this week, and now more accusations against the movie mogul.
Police in Los Angeles have opened an investigation against Harvey Weinstein regarding sexual assault allegations that date back to 2013.
That's the latest twist there on the Harvey Weinstein scandal, as reported by the BBC. The whole planet is talking about this, and this hour we're going to hear what that conversation sounds like in different countries and from different perspectives, including yours, Jasmine. You're the lead reporter for the Across Women's Lives Project here at The World. What was your first thought when you heard about this whole Harvey Weinstein mess?
Dude, I'm just so exhausted. It's just exhausting. It's this issue that you encounter everywhere, in every industry, in every part of the world when you're a woman. And it just seems to never end.
Yeah, the last 2 weeks, it's just been nonstop, and we expect it to go on, too. We're going to start today with Kim Masters. She's editor-at-large of The Hollywood Reporter and host of KCRW's The Business, and she's been pursuing the Harvey Weinstein story on and off since the 1990s. We asked her today how Weinstein is defending himself.
He keeps insisting through a spokesperson that anything he did was consensual. Obviously, that seems a bit absurd at this point with all these allegations. You know, even if you credit only like 25% of them, it's a lot. So they just keep repeating that whenever someone comes forward, anything was consensual.
And so when you say he keeps repeating through a spokesperson, we keep hearing from him like in the last couple of hours or days, or has there been a silence from the Weinstein team?
He has had some communication with a sort of tabloid Page Six reporter intermittently. That seems to have died down. I think maybe the reality of his situation that he can't brazen his way through this, as he has brazened his way through many things in the past.
Well, you met and confronted Harvey Weinstein a couple of times in the course of your investigation. What was that like?
Well, the first time it was the first time I had met him, and he asked me what I had heard about him, and that it was an off-the-record lunch, and I felt like I just had to say, I've heard you rape women, because this was in the 90s.
You said that?
I did. You know, he came into this lunch, he was very belligerent and you know, trying to put me on the defensive and saying he had disliked something I had written about, I don't even remember what, and he came, you know, barreling into the restaurant and said, what have you, why are you writing this? What have you heard about me? And I thought, you know, it was almost like, I felt like, you know, if I do not sort of lay it down right now, this is the relationship will not be the way it ought to be. He will feel that he can dominate and intimidate.
And what did he respond?
Well, as it was an off-the-record lunch, I have refrained from giving his exact response. But what I have said, it wasn't exactly a denial, and he didn't seem outraged at the mere suggestion that there were rape allegations. So, you know, it was kind of a chilling response for me. I thought, wow, you know, he almost, you know, I think he seemed to be almost entertained by his own reputation in this regard.
Wow. I'm just curious, Kim, what kind of moment do you think this has created for America and for the world? And since you're kind of at ground zero there in Los Angeles, start local and work your way outwards.
Well, obviously, Hollywood can talk of not much else. I think there's a kind of a combination. Some people are fearful and should be, some powerful people, I suspect. And some people are really hoping that, you know, that maybe they've been abused by someone and they can finally, maybe this is the moment when people will start to come forward. I mean, I did a story that culminated with the resignation of Roy Price, who's the head of Amazon Studios. And certain people who felt that Roy Price had not treated them the way he should are happy, you know, but also rattled. I think the main thing is it's a bit like, you know, this, these big trees, two have fallen and there could be more and you're just not sure what's coming. The other thing that's dangerous, if I could just say, is we cannot just follow leads without starting to taint somebody's reputation. So it's very difficult to say, let's start asking around about this, because then you know that the gossip will immediately be like it's gasoline, you know, on a flame.
That was Kim Masters of The Hollywood Reporter and KCRW's The Business. Here in the U.S., we've seen the Me Too hashtag go viral on social media in response to the Weinstein scandal. In France, there's a similar campaign, but more confrontational. Hashtag Balance ton porc, or squeal on your pig. French journalist Sandra Mueller created it to encourage women to actually name the men who harassed them. Mueller says she started by posting the name of a former boss who harassed her. She says he once told her, quote, "You have big breasts, you're my kind of woman," before propositioning sex. Mueller says he responded quickly to her post.
"I received a letter yesterday because he wants to attack me for defamation, you know? I don't know the name.
Defamation, in English. Yeah.
Yes, defamation. So he asked me to delete my tweet, but I won't. I won't. If he wants to attack me for defamation, he can, but I know I'm right. So obviously it's so easy, you know, there is two people, it's face to face, and the guy, he can speak as he wants, and I can't do anything because we were two. But I had a witness see me when I was so angry because I asked him to come and to pick me up. It was in Cannes, you know, and in French, everybody says, what happened is in Cannes, stay in Cannes. No. Now I spread what happened in Cannes, in New York, in Paris, everywhere, because it can't stay like that. We can't have harassment. It just had no respect, and he thought I was a piece of steak, so a piece of pork, or I don't know, a piece of meat. You know, I'm not. I'm just a woman.
You know, here in the U.S., we have the Me Too hashtag. How do you feel that sexual harassment laws in the U.S. compare to the ones in France?
You know, in United States, if you want to compare to France, in France there is a lot of joke. We are absolutely sarcastic, you know. I think we are going further than Americans sometimes in office. And I thought that American men are much more respectful.
So were you surprised when you saw the amount of Me Too hashtags in English?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's amazing. And I was really, really surprised too.
Now, the Me Too hashtag, unlike Balance ton porc, the Me Too hashtag does not out names. It doesn't really name names. Do you think it doesn't go far enough?
Now, the good thing is not that I don't want to be a court. I don't want to make justice. I just want that maybe some men, if they do something wrong, they just have to apologize. And if there is justice and court after, it's good.
So, but you are a journalist and you are very attuned to the importance of facts. Does it concern you that maybe some of these allegations cannot be proven?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sad for that, because there is some people who maybe don't say the truth, but I think it's a minority. I think that most of people say the truth and they don't lie.
You know, there have been sex scandals, very high profile sex scandals in France in the past, and it hasn't had this repercussion. Why do you think an American case like the Harvey Weinstein case, why do you think it had such an impact in France and in the world?
Maybe because we found that in America, you know, there is law. You have law against harassment. Your system in America is much more it's stronger than in France. So I think that in France they were really surprised.
It sounds like something you're describing, though, is almost this sense that in America we have this under control, or it's maybe this doesn't happen so much, and that illusion was kind of thrown down by the Weinstein case. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, absolutely. The illusion was just an illusion, and now the truth is coming.
French journalist Sandra Mueller, who created the hashtag Balance ton porc, or squeal on your pig.
You know, Jasmine, it occurs to me that one group of people here in the States who are even less protected by the law than most people is undocumented immigrants. And that definitely extends to this subject we're focusing on today, sexual harassment in the workplace.
Yeah, Marco. And, you know, the Harvey Weinstein debacle, it has all the markings to catch the American public's attention. Beautiful actresses, this kind of monstrous, powerful producer, well-known celebrities keeping quiet, and billions of dollars at stake. The reality is this happens all the time, and it happens right under our noses. And it often happens to women who, if they report something, it might be a matter of life and death.
Yeah, you've actually spent years covering undocumented women and hearing their stories. And this week, you called up a woman named Dilcia Molina.
Hello.
She's a therapist who works in Washington, D.C. at a place called La Clínica del Pueblo, the People's Clinic. She runs support groups for immigrant women there, and a lot of them are undocumented women who are going through these types of situations. And you started off talking to Dilcia Molina about the many reasons why undocumented immigrant women are among the most vulnerable population when it comes to harassment at the workplace.
Yeah, so one thing Molina mentioned is the undocumented female labor force. Think about the types of jobs that a lot of them are involved in. Cleaning at night,
right.
Empty buildings, private homes, places and times where they're very easy targets. But what this really is about, Marco, is total vulnerability. There's this widespread fear in the community that if you report a harasser or an attacker, if you contact law enforcement, you might get outed as an undocumented immigrant. And think about what's at stake here. If you get deported, say, back to a Central American country where there is a profound level of violence, that fear of getting deported outweighs the desire to report harassment or assault at the workplace.
So what Molina does, she runs a support group for women, but what solutions is she offering?
You know, there are resources. There's something called a U visa and a T visa, and those were created for victims to come forward and report abuse and crimes. The thing is, the application process is unbelievably backed up right now, and I've spoken to women who have been waiting for a year, living in fear of retaliation. And ultimately what Molina says is there's currently a climate of fear. And she's dealing with clients who, Marco, are afraid of going to divorce court because they worry that they're going to be intercepted by authorities.
Wow, another layer of trouble and worry for undocumented immigrants. Jazz, we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much.
Oh, it's so good to be able to talk about this.
The world's Jasmine Garz with our Across Women's Lives desk. You are my co-host this hour as we focus on the global conversation about sexual harassment sparked in part by the Harvey Weinstein scandal here in the U.S.
And still ahead, the story of a radio producer in Canada who was sexually harassed on the job for years. That's after the break here on The World. I'm Jasmine Garst.
And I'm Marco Werman. This hour on The World, we're checking in on the global conversation about sexual harassment in the workplace, because as we've been hearing, this problem goes way beyond Harvey Weinstein and the U.S.
We're going to hear now about one specific case of workplace harassment that took place in Canada. It involves someone you might have heard before.
Well, hi there. It is Friday, January 24th, 2014. It's been a tough week for Canada's two most notable cultural exports these days.
That's Gian Gomeshi, and he was a host of a radio show on the CBC called Q, Full disclosure, Q is distributed by PRI, the same company that distributes The World. As a host of Q, Gomeshi was a celebrity in Canada until the fall of 2014 when this happened.
Host of CBC radio program Q, Gian Gomeshi, who turned himself into police this morning at 8 o'clock Eastern Time, has subsequently been charged with 4 counts of sexual assault, 1 count of choking.
He was also accused of sexually assaulting a former radio producer who had worked with him on the show Q. Her name is Catherine Burrell. Catherine, thanks so much for doing this interview. Can you just take us back to when you first started working with Gian Gomeshi? In retrospect, what were the early signs that there might be trouble?
The earliest sign was actually before I even got the job, which was he had sort of heard of my reputation around the CBC, which was as a good freelance radio producer and writer. He had heard some things that I'd done on the air, invited me out to a meeting just for coffee. And it was the summer of 2006. And I remember we always kept the CBC offices really cold. So I was wearing my office sweater. And so we were outside in the sun suddenly. And I took off my sweater. I was wearing a tank top. And I remember him sitting very close to me and remarking on the tightness of my tank top, which, you know, when you're a woman in your mid-20s, if you were to sort of scream your head off every time someone remarked on your clothing, you'd just be screaming, you know, 24/7. So I saw it as a flag, but not the worst red flag. Mm. And
it was the first of many flags, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, and, you know, flags of increasing color, red, and largeness. The first big one that really rocked me was I was filling in for the show director 1 week, which required an early wake-up time. So we were doing a read-through meeting. I yawned at the read-through meeting, and pardon the language, he told me he wanted to hate me to wake me up. No one witnessed it because everyone was talking amongst themselves. So it creates this very difficult thing to pin down where you know the behavior is happening to you, but it's happening in a way that is invisible to people who would typically bear witness to it and say something. He had gotten to the point after about a year of us working together where he would come up to me while I was working at my desk for a back massage. So people would see that, but they wouldn't see the fact that his hands were coming down so that they were grazing the tops of my breasts. And then I was put in that uncomfortable position of having to sort of engage in physical activity in front of a bunch of people, which always made me feel uncomfortable. But he never really allowed you to say no to those things.
Because you couldn't say no, or you wouldn't say no to him because of his power dynamic in the office?
Because of the power dynamic in the office, and because, you know, as is the case with a lot of these people, they get very mercurial, they get very angry, and then they decide to off-gas their bad feelings about rejection in ways that are so much more psychologically abusive and invisible once again. So you don't want to put these people into moods, right? So they create a bit of a trap for you. And for me, cracking his back because he had a sore back, strangely, I much prefer that than the 2 weeks of freezing out that he would sometimes do to me when all I was trying to do was write scripts for him to read and questions for him to say on air and make the show good, or be held hostage by him because he wouldn't read and vet one of my scripts until 9 p.m. and I was stuck there alone with him in the office.
Wow.
So you really had to take what you could get, making sure that you would mitigate worse behavior down the line. From what I understand, I was the only one who got the sex stuff, and I don't know why he decided to target me in that manner, but I was the lucky one, you know, who got all the stuff where he touched my body, or he would bring me into the soundproof studio and grab my ass and say that he couldn't control himself because of my skirt. The one time that it was witnessed by a colleague, and actually he was going to be a witness when the court case came around, Gomeshi came up behind me, bent me over a desk, and grabbed my hips with his hands, and then thrust his clothed pelvis into my backside a bunch of times. And at that point, I yelled, stop. And then he did stop, and he kind of skulked away. He was angry that I had told him to stop. A colleague of mine actually witnessed that. And when everything hit the fan back in 2014, and more women started coming forward to report these abuses, I got a message from my old colleague saying, I am so sorry to say this, and I'm so sorry I didn't say something sooner, but I saw that happen to you. I just want any man at any point to say, oh God, there was an opportunity for me to do something or say something or back this vulnerable person up. And the fact that it happened, you know, 6 years after my colleague saw it, I was actually just grateful for it.
So how long did this predatory behavior of Gian's go on for before you decided you need to report it?
So let's see. Summer of 2006 was when it would have begun. And then I was there until 2010. And I tried to go to some of my superiors. And the problem was that the show at that point had become a real juggernaut. It was a show that was doing super well So that really didn't get very far. And then it got to the point for me where I was getting sick. Like, I had gained 30 pounds. I was drinking myself to blackout points over the weekends. I was using drugs. I was in really, really bad shape physically and mentally. And so I had a friend say, you might want to go talk to the union about this. So I reported it to the union in the winter of 2010 and, you know, found out exactly why women don't report these types of abuses, because I was completely stonewalled. And in fact, it made the situation worse for a while. And then I just ended up quitting.
How were you treated when your name became public last year as part of this whole trial and everything around Gian Gomeshi?
Well, my name didn't become public. I outed myself after being an anonymous source in the original story that broke this whole thing open in 2014. And the point that I wanted to make and the reason that I came out of anonymity was to tell the story that I felt I could help with, which was, here's my experience with how the system propped up this monster. And here's how I tried to put dents in the system. And this is how the system treated me when I did. Because the first thing people say when they don't want to believe a woman is like, well, why did you let it go on for so long? Why didn't you say anything? And a lot of the time women have said stuff. They've just been stonewalled and disbelieved. And there is such an incredible system of institutional disincentives that exist for brave women who are trying to come and say their piece. And when you are already in a vulnerable place and you're just trying to drum up the last few scraps of energy you have to do the fight, and then you're punched in the face again by your organization, it's like, what are you supposed to do?
So last year, Gian Gomeshi was acquitted of the charges filed against him, except in your case. How was your case against Gian resolved?
First, they tried to offer me a tremendous amount of money. It seemed as though his lawyer got a little scared about me because I had a paper trail. I had a witness. I had people who were going to be there for me to support what my truth was. And I refused to use the word story because it's not my story. They're my facts and they're my truth. And so his lawyer, Marie Hennin, offered me a settlement to the tune of what I understand was probably going to be a few a few hundred thousand dollars. I said no. And then it came back at me with something that was really interesting, which was an in-court admission and apology. You have to remember that he had basically gone underground for 18 months and said that he was going to fight all the charges and said that he was completely innocent. So I thought it would be a better resolution, not just for myself, but for the other women who maybe didn't want to step into the legal sphere, for him to apologize to me as long as I got to go out on the courthouse steps after his apology and remind everyone that this wasn't just me. This is 21 women with their own horrifying stories about what he had done to them. So he apologized to me in court, and then I put a punctuation mark on the end of the whole ordeal on the courthouse steps afterwards.
Catherine, thank you very much for telling us your story. Really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, Marco. Take care.
Catherine Burrell was a producer for the CBC radio show Q, where she endured years of sexual harassment. You're tuned to The World. I'm Marco Werman. In Nigeria, men learning how to learn about not harassing women.
During that training, the men were laughing, joking, making, you know, the trainer would say things and they would laugh because to them it sounded so silly that you weren't supposed to tell a girl, your butt looks big, you look sleepy, what were you doing all night?
Sexual harassment in the workplace on this special edition of The World. This is The World. We are a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Jasmine Garst. Today we're bringing you a special edition of The World dedicated to stories about sexual harassment in the workplace. Stories from all over the globe. Because as we're hearing all this hour, sexual harassment is a global story.
Yeah, Jasmine, I mean, it's clear that the burst dam of accusations against Harvey Weinstein spills beyond U.S. borders. In fact, one of the first women to speak up publicly about Weinstein, you'll recall, is Italian actress and director Asia Argento. She told The New Yorker in detail about being sexually assaulted by Weinstein in a hotel room in 1997, and also about feeling like she had to submit to his later advances.
It's because I was so scared of him. That man could destroy people. He could make me disappear, and my career would have been over.
That's Asia Argento speaking on Italian national TV this week. She says she feels like she's being victimized again after speaking out, except this time it's by fellow Italians. She's been called a prostitute, both on social media and in the traditional press. And she's been criticized for waiting 20 years to speak out. Argento says she had to leave Italy to get away from all the negativity.
I hope people can see themselves in all these horrible things that are being said about me now. and think about it. I am proud to have spoken up because I think this is a revolution. I am proud of being part of this moment when hundreds of women are speaking up and saying, we are not going to take this anymore.
Asia Argento speaking there on Italian TV network Rai. She mentioned hundreds of women. You know, if you include social media, I'd say we're talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of women speaking out and saying enough. I mean, it's really powerful what we've been seeing.
Yes, definitely lots of solidarity. But there have been all kinds of reactions around the world, like in China, where a state-run newspaper ran a commentary claiming sexual harassment is a Western problem.
The Chinese state media are really notoriously sexist. And so you see these kinds of things all the time.
That's Leita Hong Fincher. She's the author of Leftover Women, The Resurgence of Gender Inequality in China.
The fact is that sexual harassment and sexual assault are extremely common in China. It's a huge problem in entertainment. It's a huge problem in academia. I mean, I really can't point to a single industry where sexual harassment of women is not a big problem. But that said, there's something kind of important happening now. As of the last few years in China, there's been a rising kind of a nascent feminist movement. So there are more and more women on social media in China who are identifying themselves as feminist. And one of the big topics for these feminists is sexual harassment and sexual assault.
How much of the conversation right now has turned to workplace harassment and assault?
Compared to a lot of other countries like the US or European countries, there isn't that much of a conversation publicly about sexual harassment. But you have to understand that there's still a lot of progress. What you see today with more and more ordinary women saying that, yes, I was sexually harassed, that's a huge improvement over several years ago. And one of the barriers to even more women coming out publicly and talking about this and forcing this into the public is, of course, the fact that the government is cracking down on feminism. And so feminism has become kind of a politically sensitive issue. And so just to give you one example, in 2013, there was a women's non-governmental organization in southern China, and they carried out a survey. And they found that 70% of women factory workers had been sexually harassed, and they gave a whole bunch of examples. Well, then 2 years later, that organization was shut down by the government. So it's extremely difficult under these very tight political constraints to really, you know, have a public discussion.
What does the law look like right now for sexual harassment in China? What protections do women have?
There is some language in Chinese law saying that sexual harassment is illegal, but it's just very vague. So it's extremely hard for women to bring a lawsuit about sexual harassment. And that is another major, major problem.
So is there any push to change the laws?
Well, there is among these feminist activists, but they're all being persecuted by the government. So, you know, once you go beyond just your own individual experience, then you're talking about systemic change. And when you get to that level where you say, oh, well, we really need to change our laws, we need to change workplace policies in general, that then becomes kind of a political discussion. And it's extremely difficult within that repressive political environment to get anything off the ground.
Leita Hong Fincher, her forthcoming book is titled Betraying Big Brother, China's Feminist Resistance.
We also wanted to hear what this debate sounds like in Nigeria. That's where author and journalist Adobe Trisha Nobani lives, in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. I asked her about office culture there, and what she told me gives us a sense of where the conversation is at least in some workplaces in Nigeria.
Your boss could, you know, want to sleep with you or ask you out, or, you know, you come into the office, colleagues comment on your legs and your hips and talk about what you're wearing and tell you that they would like to marry you. You know, they joke about these things. These are just things that are so normal. When I say normal, not that we like that they happen, but they're just things that happen every day and we just blink at them. And then suddenly you find them creating a major scandal in a place like the United States of America. And suddenly we start thinking, okay, maybe it's really not a nice thing, you know. But then everybody, these are things that women deal with on a daily basis.
Tell me about a story from your own life, one of these daily aggressions that you encounter.
This was an incident that happened some years ago. I was having a conversation with somebody who was supposed to be my supervisor in a certain workplace. And then we talked about my skills and I was focusing on the things that where I felt were my strengths, my skills. And then when I finished, he said, "Don't you have any bedroom skills?" Wow. And then he laughed wildly. Well, I laughed. I'll be honest. I laughed because these things happen so regularly. We learn to deflect them with humor or you just deal with it or you frown. But on a daily basis, people are commenting on my legs. You know, your chest looks bigger than it was last week. You know, I hear those things regularly every day. And it doesn't even occur to me that these are things I should be worried about. I mean, I know the battle needs to be fought at some point, but we've learned to choose our battles. And if we started fighting about those things, some of us, you would on a daily basis, several times a day, be having arguments, having quarrels. Perhaps we need to start doing that to get them to stop.
Has it ever occurred to you after one of these episodes to report it? I mean, what would happen if you did that?
Even sometimes you go to interview some of the really top, I'm talking top, the kinds of people that everyone is scrambling to see, have meetings with them. And this is a man that the entire world wants to see. And you finally, through connections or whatever else, finally get an opportunity to maybe interview the person or get a quote. And the person says, "Come to my office." And then an hour later, the conversation turns, "I'd like to see you later tonight," and da, 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 da. And then you go for a second meeting where the person spends these hours or, this length of time talking about how he likes you and what he can do for you. And so who are you going to report to? Despite the fact that a lot of people criticize current president, President Muhammadu Buhari, the one thing they always say is he's the one president we've had who was not known for jumping on women, grabbing women or asking them to meet him at hotels, like random women, the first time ever. So who are you going to report to? The same boss who's made similar comments to you? In fact, I feel odd discussing it as harassment because I've never really sat down and felt harassed, even though these things happen to me so regularly, but I haven't had sleepless nights and gone to see a psychologist and wept about it because I guess it's part of the skills women in this part of the world develop because the men will surely do these things, you know? And I remember actually years ago when I was working in an organization that was set up by a Nigerian American and we did have a policy on sexual harassment and we had a training. During that training, the men were laughing, joking, making, you know, the trainer would say things and they would laugh because to them it sounded so silly that you weren't supposed to tell a girl your butt looks bigger, you look sleepy, what were you doing all night?
You know, I'm always struck by the headstrong qualities of singers like Nekka and Asha. What do you think about the next generation? Will they be able to address this more confidently, more aggressively?
I want the next generation of women to, you know, be able to decide what they want to happen to them, but not necessarily because that is what the women in the West have decided they want. We will evolve, things will get better, but better doesn't necessarily mean the way it is in the West. Let the next generation at least decide what they want, not necessarily because the West has done it.
Author, journalist Adobe Trishan Obane, it is really great to hear your thoughts on this. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you.
You know, Jazz, having lived for more than 5 years in West Africa, I really understood what Adobe was talking about. I found myself landing in London, working at the BBC after 5 years of living in a culture where a man is expected to be masculine and act a certain way with that swagger and confidence that, you know, pushed some men too far with that power. And frankly, I had to unlearn some bad habits, something we actually heard from some of the listeners who called us.
Yeah, we asked our listeners to call in and to tell us about having been sexually harassed. And we also asked listeners to tell us if they'd ever harassed anyone. And we got some very interesting responses.
My own experience led me to not interact with anyone, even the people that were not involved, and never felt like I could go into the office when other people weren't around. So that's my experience, and I am dealing with it at the current moment.
I've grown up in a patriarchal society that is often misogynist, and I'm 65 years old. You know, I've lived through a time when this sort of behavior, sadly, was common and accepted and even sometimes expected. And I'm on my own journey trying to reprogram myself in a way that doesn't allow that to be expected.
For me, this began when I was a teenager working jobs at cafes. There's a sort of inherent flirtation among workers. And as a woman, I learned that that was just sort of part of the dynamic of work. And that continued long into my 20s and 30s, and I never thought to question it.
Okay, so we've laid out a lot of problems here. Mm. Now let's talk about this with someone who is trying to work towards solutions. Carol Miaskoff is an associate legal counsel at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, also known as EEOC. Hello, Carol.
Hi there.
What would you say is the landmark case that comes to mind that changed the way we talk about sexual harassment?
The conversation changed dramatically in 1986 when the Supreme Court decided the Meritor case. In that case, which involved a woman working in a bank, who was subject to severe sexual harassment, sexual propositioning, and indeed a situation where the only way to keep her job was to continue a sexual relationship with the manager. And that case changed the whole conversation. What it meant is that employers knew that they could be sued and they could face financial liability. And, you know, it turned what might have been seen as a, you know, a behavior into a source of legal liability for companies and to a source of cost for companies, to put it bluntly. And as a result of that, companies started to clamp down on it.
How has the definition of sexual harassment changed, and what is it now?
The legal standard is that the harassment has to be severe or pervasive. And I always tend to think of that as it's sort of like an inverse relationship. The more severe the harassment, the less pervasive it has to be to state a cause of action.
I think a lot of women in workplaces or employees in workplaces might be confronted with smaller instances of harassment or microaggression and think, well, I can't really tell if that was just something that made me feel uncomfortable. Maybe I just shouldn't talk about it, or maybe I shouldn't report it. And it sounds like what you're saying is you can start building up a case.
Absolutely. Well, you can start building up a case, but more importantly, you should talk about it and you should complain about it, because the employer will have an interest in shutting it down, you know, before it gets that bad.
Carol, your office, the EEOC, published last year a report on harassment in the workplace. What did you identify as solutions?
Well, we identified as solutions both training, where the training takes the approach of creating what we're calling a respectful workplace. And it's sort of broader than don't harass to the point that it gets illegal. It's simply that standards of respectfulness in the workplace, in how we all interact with each other, are really important.
Carol Miaskoff, Associate Legal Counsel at the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, speaking with us from Washington. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
London's theater community confronts harassment. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Jasmine Garst. And this is The World. All this hour, we've been hearing about the global response to the Harvey Weinstein sexual harassment scandal and how it's encouraged women in many different countries to speak out against abusers who once seemed invulnerable.
In London, actor Pandora Collin has spoken out about her experiences with one theater director back in the early 2000s, sexually suggestive and intimidating behavior in auditions, plus implying to mutual acquaintances that he'd been intimate with Pandora when that wasn't the case.
And then the retaliation. When Pandora confronted this director about this behavior, she was never considered for work at this theater again. This week, Pandora described all this in a Facebook post without naming names. And the response from the London theater community has been surprising.
I'm Pandora Collin. I'm an actress. I've been doing that for nearly 30 years. Oh, these are my old headshots. These are those. I think it began with where I'd seen someone hashtagging my Weinstein. And that made me think about my experiences. And it definitely felt like suddenly that there was a sort of moment to say, this has happened to all of us, hasn't it?
Dorothy's going the wrong way.
Well, this was my play I did about Dorothy Parker. That is me. The post that I put on Facebook was about an incident that happened 2001, 2002. The first comment came, so I posted it at 6:30, so people responded immediately. So the first comment came at 6:52. I'm scrolling, and there are about 50 different replies and still going down. Loads of people say, I can have a damn good guess at who this is, which sort of says everything, doesn't it? What's that one? An actor who should be on stage but is on Facebook in his dressing room during the play says, we're going nuts in our dressing room here. We've narrowed it down to two. To which I say, that's already too many options. So somebody says, I think there's an even more potentially pernicious aspect to sexual abuse of power in UK theatre. Everyone kind of expects the Hollywood sleazebag. It's more slippery, perhaps, to call out the theatre directors who perhaps have a veneer of liberal respectability and are all the more protected and harmful because of it. In the theatre in Britain, the stereotypes that people think actors are, so lovies, who call each other darling all the time, and so that is definitely true. That exists, and it's really nice. But what it comes from is the fact that when you do a job, just what you have to do is immediately be believable as a bunch of people who have relationships, or, you know, you're pretending to be these people. So you have to be really, really open. Basically, you know, everyone's in a dressing room together, and you become really close to people really, really quickly. So I can really easily see how something like my friend's post about some people can kind of get away as giving you a bit of a squeeze and being like, what? You know, what? Just giving you a cuddle, because we're all kind of cuddly people. When you're like, yeah, I'm not stupid. I know the difference. So there's definitely that kind of, yeah, hey, relax. You know, we're all liberal artists here. Don't be so uptight. One of the differences between when it happened to me and now, obviously, there are many main differences. Like, I'm older, I don't care so much. But I think now, for young actresses, it's great that what's happening on social media, because it just does mean there's immediately a support group and a community. There's an army out there who's got their back.
That was London actress Pandora Collin describing the reaction to her post about sexual harassment. Okay, a reminder that I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Jasmine Garst.
And
this is Peggy Olson, and today's an important day, for she's starting her first job.
A promo there for the HBO series Mad Men. That show gave us a reminder, often painful reminder, of what working life was like for women in the 60s and 70s. You ever watch it, Jazz?
I've never watched it. Okay. I guess I just don't want to remember what that was like.
Well, we watched Peggy Olson as she struggled in an atmosphere of rampant sexism and harassment. But as we thought about other cultural moments where we've seen sexual harassment, I mean, it's been played for yucks a lot on TV and film. Like this classic moment with Amy Poehler, for example, as Leslie Knope on Parks and Recreation, where she's setting up a gender equality group at work.
Excuse me, everyone. Did anyone notice that there are no women on the Gender Equality Commission?
There's a lady right next to you. Oh, wait, no. It's just a very beautiful man.
Yes. Okay, we are going to need to rebalance this commission.
Yeah, notice how he said a lady next to you.
Who hasn't been in one of those groups, those equality groups?
And then there's The Office, the super awkward British version, the first one with Ricky Gervais, and what could be one of the series' top five awkward moments.
Tell me about yourself.
Last year I took a year out and I went travelling, exploring
yourself
and Asia.
Just with your boyfriend, just...
No, I was on
good, my own. By yourself, just out there. Free. Getting what you can.
You got the job. Oh, my. That is rough to hear. And going back in time, I'm going to date myself here, Jasmine. Who can forget Dabney Coleman and Dolly Parton in 9 to 5 in one of many painful scenes in that movie?
Hold it right there. Turn around a second.
Something wrong? I got something on my dress?
Nothing is wrong. As a matter of fact, everything is very, very right.
Shall we begin, Mr. Hart?
Yeah.
I love Dolly Parton so much, and I hate so much that this happens all the time.
Yeah, the exhaustion. I mean, you can even hear it in Dolly Parton's voice in that scene.
And here's another one that doesn't play it for yucks. One that takes a very different take on sexual harassment. It's from Confirmation, the HBO movie about Anita Hill's testimony during confirmation hearings for Clarence Thomas as Supreme Court Justice.
After approximately 3 months of working there, he asked me to go out socially with him. What happened next, and telling the world about it, are two the most difficult things, experiences of my life.
Jazz, I don't want to say this was fun, but it has given me a lot to think about, and it was great to hear what the rest of the world thinks about this, too, and it was great to do it with you.
You know, I'm not happy that this happened, but I'm so happy that we're talking about it. And we got so much listener feedback, and we definitely want to continue this conversation on our Facebook page. We are Across Women's Lives.
From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Jasmine Garst. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. Thanks for tuning in.
PRI, Public Radio International.